Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Our speaker is widely respected scholar of German idealism and a leader in modern Jewish philosophy, Dr. Miriam Bienenstock. Dr. Bienenstock's lecture is titled Immanuel Levinas in Context, The German Connection. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director, Alan Speight.
This is the second in a series of three lectures on the philosopher Immanuel Levinas. And our distinguished speaker, Professor Miriam Bienenstock of the Université François Rabelais, we're delighted to have as a guest both in the Institute for Philosophy and Religion and in the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies for the next couple of weeks here at BU. Last week, Professor Bienenstock spoke about Levinas's French connection, which featured prominently the influences of the French Hegelian Alexandre Kojève, as well as the critic Maurice Blanchot, among others. Tonight, the German connection with, I anticipate, an equally interesting cast of characters. We're delighted again to have Professor Bienenstock with us. Please welcome Miriam Bienenstock.
So I'm very pleased to be here again. Now I'm going to talk about the German connection of Levinas' thought. And referring to the German connection, after having spoken last week about a French one, might lead one to infer that both might be put on the same level and be comparable. This is not what I want to argue. For Levinas, the relation to Germany, a country to which he vowed not to travel anymore after World War II, and indeed he seems to have kept his vow, that relation was marred by Nazism and by the Shoah, events which also affected France, but whose effects I couldn't or didn't discuss last week. The reason I gave was that I had been educated as a philosopher and that I wanted to talk about philosophy. Another reason I could have given, but it would have been as bad as the first one, or even worse, is that Levinas himself chose to ignore those effects in France. However that may be, when talking about Germany in the 20th century, history cannot be ignored. Those events I have just mentioned loom large behind all of Levinas' writings after the war, also in Totality and Infinity, with the famous inaugural gesture in the preface, the visage of being, la face de l'être, that shows itself in war, is fixed in the concept of totality, which dominates Western philosophy. It is here philosophy as such, Western philosophy as a whole, which is attacked and linked to totalitarianism. Levinas does not explicitly use the term in the preface to Totality and Infinity, but he does use it in many other texts, and a philosopher cannot turn a blind eye to the questions which will not fail to arise when reading such a crude identification of totalitarianism to the concept of totality. It is as philosophers, in any case, also as philosophers, that we must endeavor to understand that against which Levinas turns, and then try and evaluate his criticism. Levinas's gesture echoes a gesture which had been that of Franz Rosenzweig. This was, on Levinas's part, explicit. We know what he wrote also in the preface to Totality and Infinity. We were impressed by the opposition to the idea of totality in Franz Rosenzweig's Stern der Erlösung, a work too often present in this book to be cited. In the inaugural section of the Star of Redemption, which bears the title On the Possibility of Knowing the All, Rosenzweig had, as a matter of fact, already, I quote, thrown the gauntlet to the whole venerable brotherhood of philosophers from Ionia to Jena. The in-philosophers under the spell of which the first part of his book was placed corresponds to the in-theologos of the second part and to the in-tyrannos of the last one, so that after the publication of the work, the temptation had been great to infer that Rosenzweig had not just wanted to condemn tyranny in the last part, but also theology in the second, and in the first part, philosophy as such. But Rosenzweig himself had promptly rejected such an interpretation. One shouldn't think, he had said, that the first pages of philosophical books are the basis for all that follows, and that it therefore suffices to refute them, and one would thereby have refuted the whole. One shouldn't even think that philosophy's books are especially logical, so that if you pull out the first stone, you'll have tumbled down the hole. And I quote Rosenzweig, philosophical books defy the methodological ancien régime strategy that thinks it may not leave any unconquered fortresses in the rear. They want to be conquered in a Napoleonic manner, in a bold advance on the enemy's main force, after whose defeat the small border fortresses will fall on their own. Therefore, he who fails to understand something may expect enlightenment, most certainly if he courageously reads on. And then Rosenzweig had begged his own readers to please hurry through the first volume of his work, not to tarry, for that which is important in it comes much later. When today I try to convince students to read philosophy books, I resort to another comparison, which might be more familiar to them than Rosenzweig's military one. I tell them that philosophy books are not like detective stories, which must be read orderly, avec ordre et méthode, from beginning to end, and which can be thrown away once one had identified the villain of the piece. Philosophy books should be read and reread, perused over and over again, and their beginnings may quite often be skipped, in any case left for later on. This is also what I would say about the preface of Totalité et Infini, and about the grand denunciation in it of Western philosophy as a whole, with its concept of totality. Hegel, to be sure, is involved in the accusation. But how? Last week, as I was talking about that which I called the French Connection, I evoked Kojève. Kojève, who had claimed that he was reading Hegel, and indeed he was. But then he had presented his audience with something very different from Hegel. I said that Levinas, who had heard him and heard about him a lot in Paris, had strongly reacted to him. He had resisted him. When in Totality and Infinity he wrote that religion is desire, and he wrote desire with a capital D, because this is how Kojève had written the term and spoken about it, he aimed at opposing the drug offered by Kojève. He gave to the term a meaning diametrically opposed to that which had been given to it by Kojève, and also a Jewish one. This should help us understand Levinas's gesture with regard to the German connection. It is, I think, no accident that Levinas discovered Rosenzweig in the very years 1933 to 1939, during which Kojève had been lecturing in Paris on Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. Levinas says that he first read the star in 1935. In those years, the star had not yet been translated into French. Levinas read it in German, together with other writings of Rosenzweig, amongst them the famous essay Das Neue Denken, from which I already quoted a passage, and other articles published in the same collection, Zweistromland. And then Levinas read Rosenzweig's letters, which include the correspondence with Eugen Rosenstock, and perhaps even Rosenzweig's dissertation, Hegel und der Staat. Whether or not he read the last mentioned book, or how he read it, is, however, another question. But it is not Hegel who stands at the center of the German connection about which I want to talk today. Neither is it, for that matter, Heidegger. Even if it does seem to be a kind of drug Levinas is talking about when, in a short article which was first published in 1961, Heidegger, Gagarin, and Us, he refers to, I quote, one prestigious current in modern thought which emerged from Germany to flood the pagan recesses of our Western souls, only to mention then Heidegger and Heideggerians. A few pages later, he also goes on explaining what he has in mind. This is, he says, I quote, the eternal seductiveness of paganism. Beyond the infantilism of idolatry, which long ago was surpassed. And he adds that his reflections on Heidegger are governed by a profound need to depart from the climate of his philosophy. Paganism. This would be the German drug Levinas had been addicted to, yet wanted to reject. Was Heidegger a pagan then? And his philosophy a kind of paganism? There have been arguments to that effect, but I shall not discuss them here, because that which strikes me in this context is the fact that the word Levinas uses, paganism, is a French word of Latin origin. There is a non-Heideggerian, distinctly French flavor to Levinas's argument about paganism. That word, paganism, seems to have been quite popular in France at the time, and it is certainly no accident that Kojève, whom I have placed at the center of last week's lecture, himself wrote a voluminous, 3 volumes long essay d'une histoire raisonnée de la philosophie païenne. Levinas points explicitly to Heidegger, but the roots of his argument do seem to belong elsewhere. When he writes or talks about paganism, he thus repeatedly refers to an enracinement, taking roots, and rootedness, another French word which raises many French connotations and the memory of famous French authors like Maurice Barrès, with his novel Les Déracinés, Le Roman de l'énergie nationale, and one might also think of Simone Weil in this context and of her complaint about déracinement. Although I shall mainly talk this week about the German connection rather than about the French one, I shall therefore also take the liberty of first saying a few more words about the French, this time about paganism and the denunciation of paganism. But I suspect that Levinas, when he was writing in French about paganism, also had in mind the German term of Heidentum, and also had in mind, together with the German term, Rosenzweig's politico-theological considerations on the subject in his Réflexions sur la philosophie de l'hitlérisme of 1934, Levinas had already pointed to elementary forces leading to Hitler, forces which would reach much deeper than philosophy, or for that matter religion and Christianity. He had referred to something elemental. It seems that at the time he had not yet read Rosenzweig's Star. When, only a few months later, he discovered it, he might well have been struck by the importance Rosenzweig had ascribed in it to precisely such elemental forces, the elements which make up the world of mythos and its pagan gods, form a kind of substructure of the star, one which runs throughout the work up to its very end. For according to Rosenzweig, Heidentum, paganism, does not just belong to classical Greece, a world in which it had been flourishing. Heidentum also is alive in modern times. It is indeed full of life today, and it will survive until the eternal end, not only in myth and religion, but also in the art, in the divinization of art, and in the state, that pagan god. The roots of Levinas's argument against that which I have called the German connection might well lie there in Franz Rosenzweig and in the politico-theological argument Rosenzweig had developed in the Star against Heidentum. After having allowed myself a few more words on the French connection, I shall therefore turn to Germany and mainly to Rosenzweig and Hegel, and then turn back to the first pages of Totality and Infinity and to the politico-historical accusation. And I do hope that you will not be too disappointed if I do not enlarge in this lecture, at least not directly, upon that which everybody must have been expecting, that is Heidegger and the Davos meeting of 1929. But I'll take refuge once more into philosophy and dare say that although I repeatedly looked at the proceedings of that meeting, I never found much meat in them, so that I cannot see why it should be deemed epoch-making. But then I am all ready to be convinced by other arguments. Le paganisme, c'est l'enracinement. Paganism means putting down roots, almost in the etymological sense of the word, of the term. Paganism is the local spirit, nationalism, in terms of its cruelty and pitilessness. That is to say, in its immediate, naive, and unconscious sense. The tree grows and retains all the earth its sap, a humanity with roots that possesses God inwardly, with the sap rising from the earth, is a forest or pre-human humanity. One must not be fooled by the peace of the woods. Those were the words of Levinas in the short article entitled Simone Weil contre la Bible, first published in 1952. Levinas, who was writing on Simone Weil, did seem to identify paganism with enracinement, thereby also thinking of French nationalist authors such as Maurice Barrès. Interestingly enough, however, a few years later, he does disassociate himself unambiguously from such an identification. This is what he writes in the article Heidegger, Gagarin et nous, first published in 1961. Enracinement. We should like to take up this term, but the plant is not enough of a plant to define an intimacy with the world. A little humanity distances us from nature. A great deal of humanity brings us back. Man inhabits the earth more radically than the plant, which merely takes nourishment from it. The fable spoken by the first language of the world presupposes links that are more subtle, numerous, and profound. This, then, is the eternal seductiveness of paganism beyond the infantilism of idolatry, which long ago was surpassed. The sacred filtering into the world. Judaism is perhaps no more than the negation of all that. It is Heidegger whom Levinas is presenting here. He does not present his own thesis, but rather those of Heidegger, which induces him to say that he finds the French discourse, that on enracinement, not subtle enough, not profound enough. He discovers himself closer to Heidegger than to Maurice Barrès. But he does not agree with Heidegger either, a point which comes out in his criticism of the attitude endorsed by Heidegger towards a technology which would uproot us, wrench us out of our world and place. So much has been written on this topic, Levinas and Heidegger, that it won't be necessary for me to discuss it here in detail. You'll remember that Jacques Derrida, in his famous article on violence et métaphysique, had made a point of quoting at length the texts in which Heidegger would already have answered Levinas's objections, so to speak, in advance. And then he had explained that he could see in Levinas's critique not much more than an allergy. The sacred of which Heidegger speaks, he wrote, I quote, belongs neither to religion in general nor to a particular theology, and thus cannot be determined by any history of religion. It is first the essential experience of divinity or of deity, and should have been presupposed by Levinas himself. When this was in 1963-64 in France, Derrida had written these lines. He manifestly wanted to minimize the weight of Levinas's negative remarks on Heidegger, arguing that Levinas's reaction to Heidegger was at most an allergy, would have meant that it would have been merely skin deep, superficial, a kind of skin reaction linked to the climate. For even if climate is admittedly a serious matter, it boils down to much less than substantial real motivations. We know better today, though. Allergies are serious illnesses, illnesses which can be tenacious, much more difficult to get rid of than many infections, not to speak of drug addictions. And Derrida did know, he says it, that when Levinas resorted to the term allergy, he did not do it lightly. The word, which is built upon the Greek term ergon, action, also contains the Greek prefix of allos, which means other. And this is one of the most important words in Levinas's vocabulary. When right at the beginning of Totalité et Infini, Levinas writes that, I quote, le rapport avec autrui ou le discours est un rapport non allergique, un rapport éthique, mais ce discours accueilli est un enseignement. The relation with the other, or conversation, is a non-allergic relation, an ethical relation, but inasmuch as it is welcomed, this conversation is a teaching, enseignement, it undoubtedly is to such a basic etymological meaning of the term allergy that he refers. It may well be, too, but this is a hypothesis on my part, which would need to be properly checked. I think it is correct. That Levinas, when he used that word of allergy, also wanted to take a stand against Maurice Blondel, not Charles, Maurice Blondel, who was the author of handbooks for philosophy, which were widely used in France in teaching philosophy in French secondary schools. Blondel had repeatedly argued in one of those handbooks, which bore the title L'Action, that man would be an allergy. That man would be an allergy, that is, besoin et désir des autres. However, that, and then Levinas said, no, man is not allergy, and there is ethics which defines him. However that may be, being allergic to Heidegger's philosophy would mean that once upon a time, Levinas had already been in contact with that philosophy, and that whenever he would encounter him again, he would be sensitive to him, but in a pathological and persistent way. This would also mean rejecting Heidegger's very way of understanding our relation to others, or to that which Levinas calls the other, and this is no small point. In the sentence of totality and infinity, which I have just quoted, the relation with the other or conversation is a non-allergic relation, an ethical relation. The translation of the French discours with, in English, conversation sounds extremely fashionable, perhaps even too fashionable avant la lettre. Relating to philosophy as to a conversation has become quite common today, it seems to me, particularly on this continent. However, this was not the case in Levinas's times, and even if the translation may well be an appropriate one in certain respects and with certain reservations, it does seem potentially misleading. One ought to consider here the article on ethics and spirit of 1952, the very first article amongst those gathered in Difficile Liberté, in which it is indeed the banal fact of conversation, that marvel of marvels, which is highlighted because it, in one sense, quits the order of violence. In one sense only, though, a conversation might or might not follow rational, logical lines, and it is reason, that is, logic, which, according to Levinas, in this passage is opposed to violence. Here, Levinas wants to follow a line which had been, he himself says, well indicated by Eric Weil in his Logique de la Philosophie. That which is at stake here is, in the first place, logic, that is, a reason, not primarily an ontology. And even if it is true that the adoption of a logic often entails or goes together with a certain ontology, one should keep the distinction in mind. It was not ontology as such which Levinas criticized in those years, the 60s. It rather was the persistence in it, and for that matter in Heidegger's conception of ontology as prima philosophia, of that dimension which Levinas called le sacré in French. It is such a persistence which, according to him, turns that which is called ontology into a philosophy of violence, of war, and also of power. Far from presupposing, as Derrida writes in those pages on Heidegger, which I have quoted earlier on, that the notion of sacred is first the essential experience of divinity or of deity, and should therefore have been presupposed by Levinas himself, Levinas explicitly rejected it. He claimed that one ought to carefully distinguish between sacré and saint. That distinction, which serves as a title for one of his collections of Talmudic lessons, has been translated into English as from the sacred to the holy, and in German as vom Sakralen zum Heiligen. And here again the translation seems somehow inadequate, perhaps also misleading, particularly for the German readers, because one of the authors whom Levinas most certainly had in mind, one of those he wanted to disassociate himself from when he insisted upon distinguishing between sacré and saint, had been Rudolf Otto. Otto and his book Das Heilige, a book which had been published in 1917 in German and then translated into French in 1949 under the title Le Sacré. Translating Levinas's word saint with heilig is misleading, I would think, for German readers. How should one translate it then in German and also in English? Well, I leave this important question open until next week. It was Otto who had introduced into the science of religions the notion of noumen, a notion to which Levinas refers, but that he criticizes. Otto meant thereby all that which brings men to shiver or shudder, to go into a trance, that which terrorizes, which awakes in us human beings a feeling of mystery, the so-called mysterium tremendum. Such feelings, in which Otto saw the origin of religious feelings, would arise when human beings find themselves confronted to a maiestas, an absolutely superior authority, something enormous, ungeheuer, which would fascinate but also trouble them, inasmuch as they would then find themselves confronted to something incommensurable, a holy other, ganz andere. When it is defined in that way, the numinous does not yet have the meaning we would ascribe today to that which we call sacred or holy. Otto himself pointed out that we now ascribe to these terms an ethical meaning, one which was often completely absent in older times. But according to Otto, it is in such an experience that religious feelings originate. Otto also acknowledged that if the numinous shuts itself off from rationality, it can degenerate in superstition. He wanted to distinguish a religious feeling from any superstition. He said that he had no intention to oppose the religious to the rational, and one of the main questions raised in his book was indeed that of the relationship of religious feeling to rationality. This is already clearly indicated by the subtitle of his book, Über das Irrationale in der Idee des Göttlichen und sein Verhältnis zum Rationalen. My contention is that for us to correctly understand Levinas's reaction to the German drug, that is paganism, and or Heidentum, it is much more enlightening to consider Rosenzweig and Rosenzweig's criticism of Heidentum in the Star than to look directly into Heidegger, or for that matter, into Hegel, as has often been done. I shall be referring here mainly to Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption and not to his Hegel und der Staat, one of my reasons being that in that work, which was his doctoral dissertation, Rosenzweig had not yet discussed Heidentum, or for that matter, Judaism. It is interesting and indeed quite puzzling to note in this context that Rosenzweig, who spent so much energy trying to reconstitute Hegel's itinerary, the stations of his life, and amongst them the manuscripts Hegel had written in his youth, those which have been referred to as early theological writings, seems to have spotted in them neither anti-Semitism nor anti-Judaism, contrarily to Levinas, who, in a quite well-known article published in 1971, entitled Hegel and the Jews, did not just deplore the crude, straightforward, anti-Semitic character of many sentences written by the young Hegel at the time of his stay in Frankfurt, but also the fact that, I quote, without adopting the slightest distance from it, a high-class French university lecturer had introduced them again in 1970, as if Hitler's propaganda itself did not draw heavily on this store. Levinas's reaction, which at the time was certainly justified, and also, as far as I could understand it, has been quite effective, does not lessen but rather heightens the surprise at discovering that Rosenzweig, when he studies at long length the pages devoted by the young Hegel to Abraham and the Jewish people and to the spirit of Jewish history, quotes the very same passages Levinas will quote later on, yet expresses nothing else than admiration for these writings and their genuinely historical character. His admiration seems to echo one remark of Wilhelm Dilthey, who actually went much farther than Rosenzweig, when he said, about 10 years earlier than Rosenzweig, that the fragments of the Bern period, Hegel's fragments on the spirit of Judaism, would be the most beautiful Hegel had ever written. Dilthey and Rosenzweig were talking about unpublished fragments, some composed on the basis of mere quotations from other much older writings, many actually borrowed from Tacitus, whose assertions about the Jews in the fifth chapter of his histories have served as an inexhaustible well of highly negative judgments on their religion. Here is one of the stores out of many upon which Hitler's propaganda drew. It is Tacitus who is the source of the thesis quoted by Rosenzweig in his own thesis, without at the time any negative judgment, according to which the odium generis humani, the hatred of the human species, would be at the basis of the old alliance and the soul of the Jewish nationality. Rosenzweig himself seems not to have felt any need to adopt the slightest distance towards these assertions. At the time, before World War I, Rosenzweig had been working towards his PhD thesis, and he seems to have been mainly interested in Hegel's notion of fate, of which the fate of the Jewish people merely serves to him as an example. And then Rosenzweig did not want to endorse the methodology which had induced Diltai precisely in those years to privilege Hegel's youth excerpts and manuscripts, those which he had called Hegel's theological writings, at the expense of the later work, the published writings. Still, these remarks put aside, Rosenzweig does not seem to have ever been interested, also later on in his life, in the topic Hegel et les Juifs. The topic only emerged after World War II, a point of which Levinas himself seems to have been well aware. One question, however, fascinated Rosenzweig. From the start and up to the end of his life, the theological, political one, the question of the relationship of history and of politics to religion. That fascination is indeed so conspicuous in Rosenzweig's work that the great Jewish studies scholar Alexander Altman, when he once meditated over Rosenzweig, went as far as writing in a famous article entitled Rosenzweig on History that it would have been Rosenzweig's discovery of the ahistorical nature of Judaism which would have first produced a serious crisis in his life, and that it would have been this question which would have led at the root of his intention to leave Judaism and embrace Christianity. The intention remained, we know it, unrealized since Rosenzweig finally decided to remain Jewish. And more recent specialists of Rosenzweig look to other directions. But I must say that Altman's appreciation has long puzzled me. The thesis according to which Judaism, being no folk or people in the Hegelian political sense of the word, it would lie outside history and could play no role in it, was at the time of Rosenzweig so common, so widespread, that one does not see how it would have led to a crisis in his life. Also, there is no need to ask any questions about the origins of that apolitical, ahistorical conception of Judaism. Hegel had endorsed it in his youth as well as later on. Levinas did too, which will also lead me to some questions in the conclusions of this paper and at the beginning of my next one. For the question seems not to have lost any of its actuality up to this day. But how could Altman ever have seen a crisis potential in the discovery by Rosenzweig of the non-political, ahistorical nature of Judaism? I leave the question open and merely add that Altman's thesis, his article, and of course all his other works have so many great merits which are acknowledged and appreciated, not yet sufficiently. Rosenzweig knew very well that Hegel's philosophy of history had been no eschatology, but he very consciously aimed at eschatologizing Hegel. and with the Stern, which was published after World War I, he succeeded. Before World War I, Rosenzweig had not explicitly discussed either eschatology or, for that matter, Heidentum, paganism. He had carefully examined Hegel's texts, but he had nowhere discussed either eschatology or Heidentum, one of the reasons being that these notions seldom appear in either the ones or the others. It is in 1917, in the midst of World War I, that Rosenzweig writes, in a letter which has come to be known as the Urzelle of the Star of Redemption, and the words have become famous, "The place where my cognitive clockwork gets stuck is called 1800, Hegel and Goethe, namely the absolute self-consciousness of each. Hegel's as that of the last philosopher, of the last pagan brain, and Goethe's as that of the first Christian, as Christ wanted him." And then he adds, only a few pages later, but in the same text, "The conception of immanence, and what else is paganism, that is, Heidentum, the conception of immanence which Hegel theoretically and Goethe practically led to completion is indeed itself become factum and thereby capable of becoming seized by revelation." This is, I think, the background of Levinas's stunning rehabilitation already at the beginning of Totality and Infinity of that prophetic eschatology about which he writes that it, I quote, "institutes a relation with being beyond the totality or beyond history, but a beyond which would be reflected within the totality and history, within experience." Levinas's eschatological conception, which was elaborated during and after World War II, owes many of its features to Rosenzweig. I might say a few more words on these features next week, but let me already state now that it is by means of a rehabilitation of what he calls the extraordinary phenomenon of prophetic eschatology that Levinas endeavored to react to that which I have called the German connection, a connection made up of war, but also of various theological-religious beliefs and of philosophical conceptions, which, however, seems to me quite eloquently summarized in and through the terms of paganism and Heidentum. Levinas said that in his diagnosis and in the attempt at finding a solution to the German plague, he had followed Rosenzweig. And the lead is undoubtedly correct. But it is interesting to note that he once said, in one of the very first lectures which he gave on Rosenzweig, and then he was talking about the star, not only that Rosenzweig had recognized that the system of philosophy presented in it was new, but also, I quote, that his influence, Rosenzweig's influence, on the non-Jewish philosophers in Germany has perhaps been greater than they care to admit. They never cite him. He doesn't say who these German non-Jewish philosophers are, and I do not know who was in his mind. I had the opportunity to directly ask him. I doubt that he would have answered. But I would, for my part, entirely confirm his appreciation. And in this lecture, whose subject has been the German connection of Levinas's thought, I would like to give you, by way of a conclusion, the answer I myself would give to the question, who were those German philosophers who were influenced by Rosenzweig yet never cited him? My answer is not exactly the name as the one Levinas would have given had he been ready to express himself on the subject, because the name I shall give here is a Jewish one, that of a philosopher of Jewish origin, but who was a Protestant. It is, however, one who exerted a tremendous influence upon German and non-German philosophical thought alike. It is the name of Karl Löwit, whose works Levinas knew. He also quoted him here and there. Löwit himself did, as a matter of fact, quote Rosenzweig, and Levinas had most certainly been aware of that. But although Löwit quoted Rosenzweig, this was very rare and did not occur in his main writings, which he should have done if one considers the huge debt he owes to Rosenzweig. Rosenzweig has had many readers. He has had two very famous ones, two famous children, one might say, who both attempted to identify the German plague, the drug from which one ought to free oneself, and who both followed him, Rosenzweig, by putting emphasis upon eschatology, a prophetic eschatology put in parallel with, but opposed to, philosophy as a whole. Philosophy as such, from Ionian to Jena. However, one of these children, Löwit, I would say, might well be deemed illegitimate. The other one, Levinas, legitimate. The illegitimate one, Löwit, tried to hide his father, Rosenzweig, and although he did endeavor to reclaim his inheritance, eschatology, one of his main purposes has been to throw him and it completely over, to reject eschatology. I should add at this point that I am not referring here to Löwit's work on German idealism, not mainly, at least, or for that matter on Heidegger, but to a book of his which was first published in English under the title Meaning in History in 1949, and then in German under another title, Weltgeschichte und Heilsgeschehen, die theologischen Voraussetzungen der Geschichtsphilosophie, which might be translated back into English as World History and History of Salvation. That book has certainly been, on the philosophy of history, one of the most widely read during the 20th century. And it would be easy to show, I have already partially done so in other articles, that the main line of that book, and also many of its developments, have been directly borrowed from Rosenzweig. On his debt to Rosenzweig, however, Löwit keeps a very low profile. He merely quotes him in one of or two footnotes in support for one of his own theses, namely that according to which, and I quote, there is only one very particular history, that of the Jews, which, as a political history, can be interpreted strictly religiously. Within the biblical tradition, the Jewish prophets alone were radical philosophers of history, because they had, instead of a philosophy, an unshakable faith in God's providential purpose for his chosen people, punishing and rewarding them for disobedience and obedience. The exceptional fact of the Jewish existence could warrant a strictly religious understanding of political history, because only the Jews are a really historical people, constituted as such by religion, by the act of the Sinaitic revelation. Hence, the Jewish people could and can indeed understand their national history and destiny religiously as a religious political unity. End quote. In the footnote, Löwit then says that the star, I quote, is perhaps the most penetrating contemporary interpretation of the exceptional character of Jewish history and destiny. Would he have become all of a sudden a Zionist? And an Orthodox religious one, for that matter? Definitely not. In his book, Loewit had launched a total war, not just against the philosophy of history as such, as a discipline, but also against that which had been, according to him, the source of that philosophy, namely Hebrew-Jewish prophetism. In such a total war, biblical eschatology could not but be granted a perverted meaning, one which comes out in the way in which he approaches the question of the relation to Jews and of their religion to history. Levinas, that son of Rosenzweig, whom I deem here legitimate, had read Loewit. Loewit might even have been one of Levinas' sources on Hegel, on the philosophy of history and on German idealism. Some of the main arguments which Levinas uses against that trend of thought do not stem from Rosenzweig, certainly not. They rather echo Loewit's ideas. Isn't it paradoxical or ironical to find such an illegitimate approach used by Levinas as a source? But this would be another example, and in fact quite an eloquent one, illustrating why I am referring here to a connection. And I thank you for your...
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Miriam Bienenstock. Dr. Bienenstock's lecture was titled Immanuel Levinas in Context, The German Connection, and was presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director Alan Spate. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.